Right.
on the way to his funeral. You don't believe anything. You, I think if you believe the exact opposite of what you hear in the press, and especially the Canadian and American and English press, then you're closer to the truth than if you listen to them. Chris, sadly, we're fast out of time. I hope we don't wait 3 years before we speak again.
All right. No, very good.
Again, Chris's article is Peace in Our Time, Complete and General Disarmament. You can find that. What's the website again, Chris?
New Eastern Outlook is the journal I usually write for. It's just New Eastern Outlook.
Okay, Chris. Well, thanks again. That's all I've got for this week. Until the next time. Thanks, Chris. All
right, you're welcome.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York. Guerrilla Radio is everywhere. Online at guerrilla-radio.com. Everywhere, all the time.
Invaded Russia, along with France and Italy, Japan and the UK. The troops came to stop the revolution, whatever else the lying textbooks say. If they even mention this invasion, usually it will not qualify as a footnote in the story of this nation, in which tens of millions have died. The U.S. invaded Russia, when it was invaded once again, by more armies come to stamp out Bolshevism, whose ranks were filled with German-speaking men, sent to fight and die for their Führer, on a mission to kill all the Russian Reds, brainwashed by the lying propaganda that for years had been stuffed inside their heads. The last time the U.S. invaded Russia, armies came to stop this nation state. They came from the west, north, south, and east. They came from across the Bering Strait. They came with tidings from the White House, from the men of industry, of course. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers made up this sprawling global military force. The last time the U.S. invaded Russia, it was an existential threat. When the armies came across the ocean, some people never can forget, such as most anyone from St. Petersburg, Murmansk, Crimea, or Odessa. There are still trucks standing by the road there from the last time the U.S. invaded Russia.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, overshadowed by the horrors in Gaza, in Palestine's West Bank, a modern-day pogrom is being carried out by both the Israeli government and settlers against the indigenous Palestinian population. Hundreds have been killed, thousands summarily arrested and imprisoned through so-called administrative detention measures, denied charge, trial dates, and access to either lawyers or legal remedy. The Palestinian Prisoner Society says nearly 8,000 from the West Bank and Jerusalem are held in Israeli custody of one sort or another, including women and children, with reports of physical and sexual abuse cited by Amnesty International and the United Nations Human Rights Council, who says, quote, these alleged acts may constitute grave violations of international human rights and humanitarian law and amount to serious crimes under international criminal law that could be prosecuted under the Rome Statute. Salam Hamdan is a Palestinian political activist and social feminist from Ramallah in the West Bank. She recently spoke at UVic with Professor Martin Bunton about Palestine on two states in Palestine, solution or fantasy. Welcome to the program, Salam.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Salam, Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories, in a report released a few weeks ago, she said, quote, the pace and intensity with which this violence has spread from Gaza, she means, to the rest of the occupied territory confirms that no Palestinian is safe under Israel's unfettered control. Salam, what's happening in your town, in Ramallah and the rest of the West Bank? Is there safety to be had there?
Well, actually, what's happening in my town and in the rest of the West Bank and in the rest of the occupied territories has been happening for the past 76 years. It's getting harsher right now because of this situation and because of, you know, this extreme right-wing government in Israel and with what's happening in Gaza. And because also they feel that, you know, the eyes of the world are like focused on Gaza. So they have more free hand in the West Bank. Almost daily invasions for the village, many towns and cities like Tul Karim and Jenin, kidnapping people, administrative detentions with absolutely no rights whatsoever, land confiscations, complete unleash of the Israeli settlers in the West Bank. And we are actually witnessing something similar to the broken glass night in many villages around the West Bank, where the settlers are secured and bodyguarded by the Israeli army, invading the villages, the Palestinian villages, mostly at night, destroying, burning, sometimes killing people, and nobody's doing anything at all. Checkpoints at every corner of the West Bank, wherever you move, there are more checkpoints nowadays. Like before the before October the 7th, we had approximately 650-something checkpoints, over 710 checkpoints, who are becoming more strict and more dangerous, that is to say. And and also, you know, this fragmented situation in the West Bank, you know, these areas A, B, C, I always call it the master stroke of Oslo Agreement, that has not only geographically dissected the country, let alone putting Gaza Strip far away and East Jerusalem completely far away from the West Bank, but also legally, economically, politically, socially, take your pick. So the realities are like extremely different in the different areas. Ramallah City, my town where I'm coming from, is like relatively, like in brackets, the most privileged city in the West Bank, because the international organizations are situated there, the NGOs, the banks, the Palestinian Authority, etc., etc. So in comparison to other places, it's relatively calm, although we have an Israeli military base that is right at the borders of the city, the northern borders of the city, and one of the biggest settlements in the West Bank called Beit Il. And we also have daily clashes there.
Well, and the ABC that you referred to, the Oslo Agreement, way back in the 1990s, they divided occupied Palestine into three zones, A, B, and C, and then different rules apply for different areas. And Ramallah, of course, was, according to Oslo, to be the new capital of a new Palestinian state, which is why I imagine that the NGOs and so forth are based there, as you describe them. Melanie Joly, our foreign affairs minister yesterday, Salam, she released a press release about sanctions being levied against four individual settlers on the West Bank. I'm not sure that the people in Canada understand, but when the word settler comes up, it's referred to as though they are somehow separate or extant from the Israeli government, when in fact that isn't the case. Can you describe the relationship between the settler communities of the West Bank and their organizations and the government and military especially?
Well, to begin with, this is a settler government in Israel right now. I don't have the accurate figure, but there is a big number of settler ministers. On top of them is, you know, the famous Ben-Gavir, who's calling to for the wipe off of Gaza and, you know, for, you know, unleash of the settlers in the West Bank and weaponizing them and et cetera, et cetera. He's right. He's very, like, he's a fanatic, basically.
And he's, got a very important position. He's the head of state security, right?
Exactly. He's the head of the state security, so he has lots of power. And, I mean, I find these statements a bit, if you allow me, hypocritic, because, you know, the Western governments have been supporting the colonialist apparatus in Palestine, Israel, and enabling this situation, the land confiscation and more settlements in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem, not objecting whatsoever, enabling Israel politically and financially and also with weapons, and to come, you know, at one point and call that say that we have a stand against, you know, fanatic settlers. I find this a bit hypocritic, and I don't know. It's maybe their way to say that we are, you know, I mean, we are in middle grounds here and we still acknowledge some rights of the Palestinians, but actually by the end of the day and with what's happening on the ground, this has no meaning.
Well, and just in the same manner that there is a false dichotomy created in the media, at least between the Israeli government and settlers, so-called, there's that dichotomy created between the United States and Israel, as though the United States could somehow be a neutral party in any kind of negotiation when it is so intricately linked to the foundation and the continuance of the state of Israel as it is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and this is, you know, the biggest dilemma with the Palestinian cause, actually. It's not that we are standing up to, you know, a colonialist apparatus that is Israel, but one that is supported, like fully supported, 100% supported by the strongest country on this planet, by the United States. Israel wouldn't have be able to carry on this genocide in Gaza and with its relentless wars in Gaza and the siege and all what's happening in the West Bank and the complete obstacles against a two-state solution without the prior reconfirmation from the American administration. So everything is happening now in Gaza, in Palestine, all in Gaza, of course, has a green light from the American administration.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Salam Hamdan. She is a Palestinian political activist and social feminist from Ramallah in the West Bank. She recently spoke at UVic with Professor Martin Bunton about Palestine and the two-state solution, fittingly in an event titled Two States in Palestine, Solution or Fantasy. Before we get to that question, Salam, today, the Israeli government sent their representatives to the International Court of Justice to answer yesterday's submission, second submission from the government of South Africa, on the cessation of the ceasefire immediately. I watched Adila Hassim of the South African delegation, one of the lawyers on the panel that they sent forth, and she was absolutely brilliant and riveting. Did you by chance get an opportunity to see any of those submissions?
Well, I've seen actually part of it, but then I mean I couldn't family urgency, I couldn't continue watching it.
Well, I recommend it to everybody. It's absolutely riveting. But today, I didn't watch, as I'm sure millions more didn't as well, Israel's rebuttal. But I did read briefly that the Israeli delegation said, quote, that there was no patient nor medic harmed by the IDF at the Al-Shifa hospital. Do you want to remark on the credibility of the Israeli statement in that instance and in other instances regarding what's been going on in Gaza?
Like Ashifa Hospital has been destroyed and over-destroyed multiple times, and a number of mass graves have been found there. Most of them are women and children. Most of them are patients, are still in the, hospital uniform. And of course, a big number of the medical team there. So this is like so absurd, mind-blowing that they say that this. Who has done that? 400 bodies have been found so far under Ashifa Hospital and around Ashifa Hospital in these huge mass graves. Who has done that? They're not allowing international media into Gaza. They're not allowing international organizations to observe and to investigate. So, and the United States, whenever something happens in Gaza, a huge massacre, they say that they need to investigate what's happening with Israel, with the occupying apparatus of Gaza Strip, with the military that is occupying and destroying Gaza.
Well, in trying to explain its bizarre statement, as you described beautifully, the Israeli legal team said that the proof required for the International Court of Justice to take action cannot be met while a conflict is ongoing. It has to wait until they say, quote, after the conflict has concluded. And it seems to me this is Israel's plan all along, is to just talk and talk and talk as it destroys Gaza entirely, making a return impossible. When you say that they don't, that media is not allowed into Gaza, they're not also allowing in Europe anyone give testimony that could put the lie to Israel's crazy claims. Dr. Professor Rassan Abu Sitta was scheduled just last week to testify in front of the French Senate about what he had seen as a frontline doctor in Gaza, and yet he was stopped at the border under a German order and refused entry into all of Europe using the Schengen protocols, which just yesterday have been reversed. But his testimony, I haven't heard if his testimony will be rescheduled for the French Senate. I would be surprised. What's your reaction to the way Europe has turned a deaf ear to what's happening in Palestine?
Well, I'm not completely shocked because we Palestinians have been used over the past decades on these double standards from the Europeans and all this, hypocrisy and, the call for two-state solutions on one hand and enabling Israel to hinder that on the other hand. The double standards when it comes to any other entity around the world versus Palestine, like what was the war on Ukraine and how they have reacted to that and how they have been reacting to Palestine over the 76 years and granting Israel a full impunity. And actually, this is where Israel is extending its power from, because they know that they can get away with anything, basically, and everything. And this is what they're doing right now. So I'm not really shocked. It's blowing that, these, countries that, preach democracy. You don't know how many millions they are pouring in our countries, including Palestine, annually, to preach democracy and good governance and human rights and gender rights and et cetera, et cetera. But when it comes to Israel, Israel is excluded from all of that. And the Palestinians have to be muted, not only the Palestinians, anyone who is in support of the Palestinians. I've heard this morning, I've read somewhere that Professor Ilan Pape, yes, prominent Israeli historian, a famous Israeli historian, who's been uncovering the massacres that took place in 1948, and he's been writing about Israel and what Israel is doing, has been stopped in the United States in one of the airports and interrogated for hours. And his telephone was confiscated, and all the data on his telephone were copied. And he's been interrogated for, you know, speaking about the genocide that's happening now in Gaza around the world. So it's not only about the Palestinians, it's about everyone who dares, including the Jews themselves, to criticize Israel. And this association between the anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism is going on in Europe, mainly in Germany, and is actually blocking the people who are trying to criticize the occupation.
Yes, and that was at Detroit Airport, and the same treatment was meted out to Professor Abusita as well, with his electronic devices all taken and presumably copied, and the information fed to who knows who throughout the various Western intelligence apparatuses. We're fast running out of time, Salam. I want to get your opinion. We've seen that every single university in Gaza was leveled flat. Many of them demolished, were used as prison and torture centers by the Israeli army. Watching Electronic Intifada the other day, Ali Abu Nima was talking about how education is a Palestinian value of utmost regard. What is your reaction when you look here in the United States and now in Canada and spreading at the college campus revolt trying to bring a ceasefire?
Hope. It's not my only reaction. It's the reaction of every single Palestinian I have talked to. Hope. This is giving us so much hope, because the world has been silent for so many years, and because so much has been happening even before the 7th of October in the past 6-7 years in the West Bank and in Gaza Strip, and Palestine wasn't on the map anymore, and the world stopped talking about Palestine, including the Arab states, our neighbors and our brothers. So this is putting Palestine again on the map. We believe that the universities are a big power around the world, and they are like, you know, the spark for every cause. I mean, we still recall what the American universities have done during the war on Vietnam back in the 60s, and how they have sparked this huge movement against the war. And we also believe on the awareness of the new generations, and it's giving us a hope, because as I told you before, Israel wouldn't have been able to do any of this and to continue its occupation without the full support and the full impunity granted by the United States. So especially in the United States, this wave has the prospect, I believe, to make some change, even if slowly, in the American policy, and this will have a great impact on us, on our cause. It will give us some hope that this nightmare might have an end at one point.
Well, and that hope is that it ends sooner than later, of course. And then there's the next day. As I mentioned earlier, you spoke recently up at UVic with Martin Bunton, two states in Palestine, solution or fantasy. Can you answer that question in 3 minutes?
Yeah, I've been believing always in the two-state solution. But now, I mean, living in the West Bank and seeing that in every corner, there is a settlement, an Israeli settlement, roads that are blocked, the face of the Palestinians, a relentless apartheid regime, the wall, You know, and these fanatic governments, and also this, you know, this fanatic discourse in Israel, which has like a very fascistic tendency. I don't see how. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the map in Palestine, it doesn't even resemble a Swiss cheese. Dots of settlements everywhere, and fragmented geography, and fragmented political movement in Palestine. The national movement is completely crushed. I don't see how that would happen. I mean, they do not see us as humans anymore. I mean, on their TVs, they are calling us subhumans, animals. The defense minister at the dawn of the war in Gaza, he said, we are dealing with human animals, and we act accordingly, and they are actually doing this. So a two-state solution, this is becoming like, I don't know, a mirage, something that is not realistic at all.
And what's
it might be more realistic to call for a one democratic state solution, but this is also a fantasy.
Yeah, that was my next question. What would be the option? Is it possible, especially after what we've seen in these last 7 months, for a single state solution, as some had argued, that because it's a de facto single state right now, albeit an apartheid one and extremely unjust, is the only solution a single state solution with actual democratic provisions and social justice measures, etc.?
Let me put it like this, Chris. Without the end of the Zionist ideology, there is no prospect for any kind of solution, nor a one state, nor a two states, not anything at all. And it's going to be extremely hard for the future of the two nations on this land.
Well, Salam, you're going home soon, back to Ramallah. What news will you take back with you to Ramallah of your stay in Canada and of Canadians?
Well, actually, this is not my first visit to Canada, but this is the most pleasant visit, because I've been extremely desperate and frustrated here when I arrived because of this war taking part in my country. But then I went down to the street downtown to Victoria, and I've witnessed that people are like, you know, demonstrating on weekly basis, nonstop, for 7 months. And it's growing further and further, and they are organizing events everywhere. And then this encampment in Victoria University that is like, you know, copying what's happening in the United States and in some European countries is very much uplifting. Even before going home, I'm contacting my friends in Gaza, and I'm telling them that for the first time, there is hope. People are changing. People are now more aware. The new generations are more exposed. They're not only limited, you know, to this classic mainstream hijacked, I call it, media in the West. But they have, you know, their platforms, their social media. And they know actually what's happening now. And it's giving us hope, because they are standing up to their governments. They are writing letters to their politicians. And they are, enforcing their voice.
Well, Salam, I'm glad that you came to use your voice to reiterate the desperate message that we're trying to amplify here in some small way. Thanks a lot for coming on the show, and good luck on your return journey, and bon voyage.
Thank you very much, Chris, for having me on your program. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course, and I want to thank, too, Chris Black for coming on, and thank all of you for staying tuned. That's all I've got for this week. Until the next time, thanks again, Salam.
Thank you.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999.
We're running out of time to put out a fire.